Welcome to the Perfect First Layer Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast where we answer questions from you, the 3D printer community. I'm Guy from Guy's Shop, and as always, off mirror are my co-hosts, JJ and Nathan.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And we do depend on your questions for this podcast, so if you have one for our panel, please go to perfectfirstlayer.com, go to the submit page, and send it. And we also have a Patreon, and we only have one level right now, and we're simply asking for a small donation to help keep this podcast going. So please go to patreon.com/perfectfirstlayer. It's easy to write, not easy to say, I guess. What do you got going on in the lab right now, Nathan?
Well, I'm just trying to put the whole, you know, YouTuber thing together and get my, I don't know, not a whole lot, really. I got a lot of projects that are in the cooker for of longer term. So yeah, no quick turnaround stuff this week.
No,
nothing
new.
Got some machines I can't talk about, some other stuff, but yeah, haven't been in the tinkering spirit lately.
So what the heck you been doing with yourself?
Planning. It's all about planning out.
Yeah.
What we're gonna do next.
Plan, do, and act. There you go. What about you, JJ? Anything? Any new?
Yeah.
Anything? Any news on the Orange Storm Giga?
Did have one issue with it, which is unfortunate. It's 1 kilogram into a giant octopus print, and the resume function seems to be wrong on the firmware that was loaded on it. It's still like a pre-production firmware on it. But it failed to resume correctly. And so I've got to figure out
a big print.
It's a huge print. And so I'm trying to dig in the firmware. I think I tweaked it to get it working, and I think I can have it resume a new print kind of on top of it, get it working. But it's such a funny, you know, 800 grams into this print, and I don't want to just throw that away again, because I did have a print fail that I started the first octopus on a 500 grams that did get lost now. So now I restarted it, and I'm like, okay, I don't want to waste another almost full spool on it.
So with a printer that big and a build, I should say, with a build volume that big, do you feel obligated to print like huge things on it?
I printed some small things and it prints great as a small printer. Like the small prints you get off of it are like, well, it works well. But yeah, I do feel like as a YouTuber with a big printer, I've got to maximize everything on here.
See, I would think that having a printer that size would be good as far as the X and the Y. I don't see why it needs to be 20 feet tall.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Have it's like so a tall. 350 or so height build volume on it. You took something that big as far as the bed goes and then put like two or three heads on it. So you could print
eventually I think they will be releasing 4 heads you can add to it. So kind of an IDEX style, like just multiplying, you can print 4 things at the same time, which makes a ton of sense. But if you're printing 4 things, you don't need it to be that tall. And then you could
get it through a doorway.
You could turn it sideways, fit it through a doorway. You could build a shelf and put 2 of them on top of each other in like a standard 8-foot room. Could make a lot of sense if it was half at the height. Because a full meter tall build volume is huge. Yeah. And barely anything needs to be that tall.
Every now and then I come across one of these videos where this like it's a commercial sign making. And they have printers that like that are just have these huge beds, but they're only like, you know, 50 millimeters tall build volume. They're almost next to nothing, but they're just huge. They're the size of a pool table.
Yeah.
See, to me, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to change
even
it to
like
the...
So many designs I have, it's like, you scale up the octopus, for example. It's like, well, it using half of the height. Or just other prints you scale up. It's not using a full meter tall size. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say you could change the name to Orange Kiddie Pool.
Yeah.
Instead of the Orange Storm.
Would make good for Kiddie Pool. Or I'm planning on printing some like planters and such for around the yard. Just because like it's, well, now I could print whatever size or shape planters or kiddie pools or water fountains, whatever I want.
I still say you need to print a toilet.
Oh, yeah. A full-size toilet.
I just think it would be really funny.
I need to order some gold filament for a golden gold toilet in the front yard.
Put some flowers in it. Your neighbors will just love you. Your
neighbors will love me. Yeah, it'll be great.
Anything else going on?
Nothing. No new printers, I would say.
No. I saw the one video you had, the short of the PETG in the water. Is there anything after that?
Yeah, so I keep cycling it through new drying cycles. So mm-hmm. I need to actually try it now that it's been printed, now that it's been dried, or I hope it's dried. Every day I'll put it through an 8-hour cycle.
8-hour cycles has been through.
Because it was so waterlogged, and I hope it didn't. It almost did damage the dehydrator because it was mm-hmm. so soaked with water.
Yeah, where does that water go in the something like that? It's got to go
initially,
somewhere.
Initially, it dripped down into the screen, and so I couldn't use the screen. So I had to like turn it upside down for a while. Brief background, I soaked a spool of PETG in a bucket of water for a month and then put it in this Creality dehydrator to try to revive it. But I didn't let it, drip dry enough until I put it in there. And so then some water dripped into the screen, so I couldn't use the screen for a bit. So then I turned the dehydrator upside down for a day or so, and then it cleared up, so I could use the screen still. So I've been running it on like 8-hour cycles most days, so I do need to get back to seeing how it actually prints now. It printed great. Like, I was so impressed with how the Ender 3 V3 worked. Like, there's no stringing issues or anything. It just
Does it make like weird popping and sizzling noises?
Yes. Yeah. It makes popping and sizzling noises. And the print looks like cast iron at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, it looked pretty cool.
It looked cool. I was like, whoa, I was expecting a stringy mess, but there was no stringing involved. So it worked mm-hmm. great. And I'm hoping to be able to revive that spool. That's the goal of this experiment.
Cool. Well, I got in a new laser engraver. And the main reason I'm looking at it is because I want to start doing some inlay with it, a marquetry woodworking thing. That makes sense. And it does work well for that. I'm having a few issues. I don't want to get too deep down that rabbit hole, but it works pretty decent. But I also did have a thing where I had to make 120 state of Indiana cutting boards. So I spent a couple days on my CNC machine doing that, which is just... It's just boring. It's just boring. But it cuts it so quick. I had the blanks they gave me to do it. I can only do two at a time. I could have got four on the machine, but I can only do two at a time.
Yeah.
So it cuts two in like 8 minutes, and I got to pull it off, put another one on, pull it off, put another one on, and do that, 60, 70 times.
It gets
a little old real quick, and it's noisy. It's super loud. And
oh, yeah.
The dog definitely did not like it. When I was home.
Can you say what laser it is?
So the X-Tool S1.
One of those.
I had another company send me one. I'm not going to say who it is because it sucks so bad. That was, you know, still a $2,000 laser thing. It just sucks so bad. It's like, take it back. I don't want it.
Yeah.
It was just horrible. It worked, but when you really dug deep into it, the precision of it was off. So if I tried like cutting a square, and it wouldn't work for inlay, which is what I want it for. So if you look at like a square, I cut a, you know, in CAD, I drew a square that was 6 inches square, right?
Yeah.
Cut it on this thing in the center of the bed, not at the edge of the bed or anything like that, but in the center of the bed, and I hold a square up to it, and it's off on that 6-inch stretch. It's off like 2 millimeters out of square.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, you know, almost an eighth of an inch.
Yeah.
It's just horrible. I tried doing a circle, and it looked like an egg when you looked closely.
Oh, wow.
So it was, and I emailed them. I said, what about this? And they went, well, do this, do that, do this. And I spent like another day screwing around with it. And I said, I don't want to take it back. So this one, I haven't had any issues with. It works really, really well.
Lasers are such the easiest thing a company can make, where it's like, it's just an XY axis and put a powerful laser on there and sell it.
Well, the thing I did not like about my other lasers is every time I tried to do something on it, it was a 3-hour ordeal. Getting everything all focused and doing this and that, and the material is a little different. So it was just too much. You know, trying to do a 15-minute job, it would take 3 hours to set up.
Yeah.
And I just didn't use it because of that. So I was looking at this machine mainly because they've got their own software and it's easy to use, and it is easy to use. I don't have to spend days trying to figure out what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's the
software is the thing that 3D printers have that lasers do not have.
I mean, that Lightburn software is good and it's powerful, but I don't know what 90% of the stuff does.
Yeah. It's I'm just nothing trying to about get the, Cura, like, you know.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get the thing to work decent. I don't want to spend that much time screwing around with the software.
Yeah. So. Where the people rag on Cura for sure, but the best of laser software is still miles behind the worst of 3D printer software.
I don't have a problem with Cura. I just don't like that it takes 20 minutes for it to slice something.
Yeah.
It's like a button and you think your computer's locked up. It's like, what the heck?
I don't know what the Elegoo. So I downloaded Elegoo's Cura for the big Ornstrom Giga, and it's pretty good time wise. Like, I'll load a giant octopus on there and. It's way faster than I think it should be.
Doesn't it tell you what version of Cura it's based on somewhere?
Yeah, it's based on an older version of it. But I just get surprised when I'm loading stuff and it's like, oh, okay, it's done. Oh, cool.
It didn't take 2 hours.
I'll use it.
Yeah, see, I would think you're slicing something that big. It would take a while.
On Cura, I've had some long slices before, so
well, if it's over about 15 seconds, I'm wondering if something's wrong. 15 seconds is a long time on Orca or Prusa.
Yeah.
So, all right, you guys ready to get into some questions?
Yeah, let's get into some questions. Maybe we can get one from that guy. What's his name? Is it Leaky?
Yeah, well, we'll get there.
Okay,
Leaky. Right, we can do his. This question comes from Leaky Bum. I really hope that's a a fake name because I'm laughing. He says, I really enjoy the podcast. Keep up the good work. He's asking, and this is something we talked a little bit about, but not in depth, the type of question it says he's got here. It says, what is the correlation between layer adhesion and a matted or shiny finish of an ABS print? Doesn't shiny finish mean better layer bonding? I want the strongest parts possible. My chamber temps can reach 65 to 70 degrees C on a Voron. That's pretty high. What's confusing me is when I run a volumetric flow test through the Ellis tuning guide, it says to pay attention to where it transitions from melted or matted to shiny. So which is better layer adhesion for ABS? Leaky bum. So I can't remember. It has something to do with the heat, right? If it's hotter, it's more shiny, and lower temperature, it's more matte, correct?
That's usually how mine comes out.
Okay.
When it's leaky.
Is there a difference between layer adhesion?
So generally, the higher the temperature, the better the layer adhesion.
Does that have to do with the modulus of elasticity?
Probably not.
I just thought I'd throw that out there.
They might be distantly related, but yeah. So really what you're doing is you're just melting two pieces of plastic together. And if one of them is super hot, then when you drop it onto the other piece of plastic, it'll melt onto it more easily. So that's why when you're extruding at lower temperatures, you get worse layer adhesion usually, and higher temperatures will produce better layer adhesion.
Okay. Well, that's what I would think anyways. Do you have any experience with this, JJ?
Yeah. So there's for sure that transition is where you're getting the best, adhesion between matte and shiny finishes. But there's a huge range of things of temperature and speeds affects how much the filament is melting inside of that melt zone. Yesterday, it's a perfect question for yesterday. I did a bunch of calibration on a spool of PETG printing on it. 2 millimeter layers, so very thick, but the dialing in speeds versus temperature versus if it's too slow, then the filament heats up too much and will start bubbling and you'll get bubbles in there and it produces a matte finish. If it's moving too fast, it's not melting enough. If it's too cold, it's not melting enough. If it's too hot, it's overheating. If you overheat them, you get bubbles in there. So it's all about like hitting the right speeds and temperatures. And it was really interesting how much the dialing in of both of those could be. You're hitting a sweet spot in the middle of the right amount of shininess to not get too much bubbles on too hot and over melting. Overmelting and overheating produces too much bubbles.
I've printed out those temperature towers before.
Yeah.
And I'll be really honest with you. I mean, I see some very small differences, you know, and that's from going, you know, like the difference between like 230 and 200. There's some difference, but some of these 200 to 210, I don't see anything. And people, you have all this stuff here. I'm like, no, I don't see anything. Are my eyes just bad?
No, for the most part of PLA printing, I would say you're good. I printed PLA from 200 to 230 on these fast printers. And it's like, well, it works.
Sure.
So, totally getting your side of like, well.
But have you ever turned the temperature down to get a matte finish and then find out that you're having problems with layer adhesion?
Mm.
Yes. I think that's a question.
Yeah. So like on Bamboo Lab printers, especially with their stock profiles, they're kind of set up to go high speed, and you'll get a lot of matte surface finish on those, but that comes at the expense of being more brittle and like having more layer adhesion issues. So yeah, I mean, that's just practically when you look at the old school Ender 3s where everything's moving slow and has plenty of time to melt and get laid down, we didn't really have to worry about that much. But now that everything's so fast, like you can be moving so fast that it doesn't have enough time to heat up the filament. So it's like your effective extrusion temperature goes down when you increase in speed.
I don't know if I've ever had a layer adhesion problem on my Bamboo printer. I just haven't experienced that.
Mm.
So
well, if you were pushing it to way faster, especially you will get a matte finish versus a shiny finish on different surface objects. Right. So different objects, it'll print at different speeds. So if it's printing a long straight line, it'll print it at a slower melting temperature. It will be able to melt less on a long straight line. So it'll be more matte, and then, which shows up a lot on your prints. Yeah.
I know that
I've had
a print going on my Voron. It's like, well, okay, it's going to take 3 hours. I need it faster. And this, I really don't care.
Yeah.
So I'll put the thing up to 250, 300%, and it flies around at, you know, pretty high speeds. And of course, there's a big difference in the sheen. I think the faster it goes, it gets matte.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like the first half of it, the first quarter of it's shiny, and then it, you can tell when I started. But again, I've never really worried about layer adhesion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. And my question to Leaky Bum would be like, why are you in a situation where you need to get the last little bits of layer adhesion strength out of your printer? For the most part, 3D printed parts, from like everything that I've seen them used in for hobby use, they're never really under that much stress. And if you're getting close to the point where it's about to break, then you can probably just redesign the part and make it a lot thicker or add some bolts in it to reinforce it.
Yeah, that makes sense. He also says here that he's getting his chamber time 65 to 70 on a Voron. It's pretty high, man. I don't think I've ever seen temperatures that high inside any of my printers, other than the Chitty. And that thing with the heated chamber, I have to have running for like maybe half hour, 45 minutes just to get to around 50 degrees. No, it's also in my garage. It's just a little colder, but
yeah.
Anyways, all right, let's move on to the next question. And this comes from, if I can find it here, hey, having all kinds of problems. Right. All right, this is another filament question. So this is from Max, and he says, hey guys, I like how manufacturers clearly label their filaments what type of filament it is, PLA, PETG, ABS, ASA, and so on. But what I don't like is how different brands or manufacturers' filaments differ from one another. Not all PLAs are the same, even though the type and color are the same. So that makes me question. What the heck these manufacturers are mixing into their filaments? Is there any regulating body like the FDA for food stuff? How are these random brands, funky named Chinese brands, able to offer filaments from time to time on the market? And he's looking forward to the next episode. Thanks, Max. So I've experienced this before when I've like had the same color filament, run one out, but a different brand, same color, and then finished a print with it. There's been big differences between the two. And it mostly has to do with the color. But I haven't experienced much other than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like one, Overture's red and other companies red.
Yeah.
Not being the same red, red.
Yeah. This was black. When's the last... That's the difference.
When's the last time you had a bad batch of filament?
I've had a weird batch recently from Sliceworks or something. It smells weird when printing. It's like it's all chemically. Like I had to put an air filter near it because it's like, really? Ugh, this just smells. The whole basement smells chemically when I'm printing with it. I like colors and stuff, but just like, it's just funny the difference between, it's a PLA in a certain color, in a Makita teal, which is beautiful. I love the color, but it just smells weird.
Somebody sent me some filament and they sent me two rolls of it. It was white and I couldn't get it to print in anything. Any printer I put it in clogged. Didn't matter what temperature, it just clogged. So I threw it out.
Of a PLA? Or...
Yep.
Huh.
PLA. Yeah.
After clogging every one of your printers, you were like, you know what?
it happened to me, I think, three times. It was like one roll, and then I dried it, and then the same thing happened on a different printer with that roll after drying it. And then I said, okay, it's just probably something wrong with this one thing.
Yeah.
So I opened up the other one. Dried it, put it in a machine, and it clogged that one. I said, I'm done. I just took, I took two rolls of it and I threw it in the trash.
Was it, it was just clogging, not cracking. I've had spools that, or there was one recently that I loaded in the A1 Mini's little filament exchanger and it cracked in the spool.
The Bowden
reverse
tube.
Bowden tube, I guess you could call it.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, this spool. Nope. Yeah. So very different between clogging a nozzle versus it physically cracking because of the bend.
Yeah. I don't know. We've kind of talked before about, you know, the differences between some of these PLAs, but I mean, is there really that much difference between all these PLAs? How many actual factories are there making this stuff? You know, that's the other question. So you might have, I don't know. I don't know the answer at all. So I know with a lot of things in the world, you may have one company. A really good example is like water heaters. You know how many manufacturers of water heaters there are in the United States?
One.
Two.
Okay.
Two.
Everything is made by those. And you go into Lowe's or Home Depot and you'll see 15 different brands. They're all they're all made by this. They all come out of the same factory and they're just different labels slapped on it. And they're made a little bit differently. But I don't know if that's the same thing with filament. Is there like two or three people actually making this stuff and then other people are just rolling it onto their own spools?
Yeah, so I don't know how many exact PLA pellets manufacturers there are, but there are fairly small. It is a fairly small amount of pellet makers of that raw material. And then there are more amounts of each brand you buy from is taking those pellets and then adding their own colorants to it.
Well, that I dig that. I'm saying, there somebody that is actually extruding the filament, and then people are just buying these big, huge, you know, house size rolls of it and putting it on their own spools in a different factory?
I don't think so. Or I'm not positive, but I really don't think it's that, because buying these spool makers from pellet to spool is a simple process. So I don't think there are, I don't think there is a giant people making giant spools and then people just cutting down the spools into giant to small 1 kilo spools to sell.
There are white labeling filament services though. There's a big conspiracy theory going around that Bamboo Lab matte PLA and Polymaker's PLA is exactly the same. People put them side by side and be like, it looks the same. Look, it's the exact same color.
Yeah.
So for all I know, they might be the same material, like the same filament coming out of the same factory, just made to order by two different companies. Unless a company is like publicly going out and being like, hey, look at this. This is our equipment that we do this on. Like a couple examples are Prusa and there's a local company called Fusion, and you know, JJ toured
American filament. And I know their spool maker. So
yeah,
I've seen that one.
So like, unless the company is really showing you that part of their operation, then I'd probably say it's pretty safe to assume they're having it farmed out to someone else.
They could be. Yeah. Or this is a long time ago, but Amazon had a brand of filament that was really just Overture. They were buying Overture filament and putting their own label on it.
Slap it right over the Overture label.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, they knew, Overture knew they was happening type thing.
They don't care because they're buying it from
you're
them.
You're selling filament to Amazon. Great, cool. Yeah, it's fine with them. It's totally makes sense. These companies are selling it to another one. Another interesting thing this gets into is PLA plus of, you don't know what that plus means in so many realms of what that company puts in there. Like PLA is a simple, it's a molecule. It's a, polycule, whatever you call it. And then a colorant is a colorant on top of that PLA. But PLA plus does get into the realm of like, well, is it stronger? Or is it printing faster? Is it flexible more? Or is it, you know, like...
I think the word you were looking for there, JJ, was polycule. There's a molecule and then there's a polycule.
Molly and then poly.
Yep. Zach Friedman did a pretty good video where he was talking about different types of PLA and talked about the specific additives that they use for matte and PLA plus. He said that it was like they use specific materials for those types of PLA alloys, I guess we'll call them.
Yeah, that's
a good but idea. I would imagine since there's no oversight and there's all sorts of polymer chemists all around the world, that everyone is going to have their slightly different secret recipe that they can throw in like a little bit of whatever, like a couple pellets of this or that and make it better and, you know, have their own brand advantage. But it's not like they have an ingredients label where you actually know what's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Unless they do. And like, it's just one of those questions that I've heard from my siblings, them being like, what is PLA plus and should I be buying that? And I'm like, you need to learn what that means. Like from every company, that means something different.
I'd like to see PLA minus.
Yeah. Can you get less PLA in here?
Well, you also ask the questions, you know, like what about a regulating body for this stuff? And we've touched on this once, I think a long time ago. You know, who would be the regulating force behind something like this? Anything the government gets involved in, it basically is just really expensive and gets screwed up. So I don't know if that's the answer, but for everything else, there's anything with chemicals in it. I mean, there's all kinds of regulatory bodies that monitor this stuff to make sure that they're not shipping poison in something.
Yeah, but let's just make sure there's no uranium colors, uranium orange glowing PETG.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what would that look like, I guess, is my question. Having a governing body do this would then we would know what PLA plus is,
or the like to know that it's not containing uranium, not containing lead, not containing, you know, nasty chemicals in there. But there really isn't any oversight of saying what additives are being into a PLA plus colorants are being added.
It's still a type of chemical that you're melting, and it's releasing VOCs into the air in some cases. Yeah. So you would think that they would, in the United States, they would be required to have an MSDS or an material safety data sheet on it available. And they don't.
Yeah.
You know? Can you get an MSDS for Play-Doh? Like, it's like you can get it
probably.
Oh, yeah, I guess
yeah,
so.
Yeah, probably.
Like epoxy paints, they'll all in solvents, they'll all have MSDS data.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked for companies where we've had service trucks going out and installation trucks going out and installing stuff. And it's something as simple as having, I mean, every truck had to have an MSDS book in it. Mm-hmm. And anything that was liquid in the truck had to have an MSDS sheet. So
sheet.
H2O.
Yeah. Well, and you couldn't, I mean, if you had like Windex, you couldn't put it in a different container other than Windex. It had to stay in the Windex bottle. Put it in a smaller bottle.
Or a Gatorade bottle.
Yeah, or a Gatorade bottle. And you had to have an MSDS sheet in the vehicle. So I don't know if that's an Indiana law or a federal law, but I know that's the way it is here. So why not the same thing on PLA or all these filaments? Like I said, they're releasing, if you can smell them, they're releasing something in the air. Those are particles.
So like, I don't know, does toner and ink for a inkjet printer, do those have MSDSs?
Probably. I don't know.
Probably out there, yeah. But yeah, different filaments smell different ways. And it probably should be releasing.
Well, like I said, if the government, if our government anyways gets involved, then it'll just be really expensive and it'll just get worse than it is now. But I really don't know if it's a problem right now.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting, I guess. So let's get to another question here. And this one comes from Adam. And he said, you had a question previously of someone who acquired an X1 carbon for work. They're very happy with it and asked for a recommendation for a second printer, something in the $2,500 range. I was waiting for you to recommend the Bamboo Lab X1E because that is exactly the price of that machine. But there was no mention of it. The hot end gets hotter and it has a full LAN-only capabilities. It seems like this machine is the reason we don't have full LAN mode on the X1 Carbon because they want to charge you an extra $1,000 for that capability. To me, this is a bad reason to withhold software features on X1 Carbon with the $600 Creality K1C able to do full LAN mode out of the box. It seems to me its direct competitor is really the $2,500 Bamboo X1E. What do you think? Keep up the great work. Best 3D printing podcast there is. Oh, thank you, Max. Or Adam.
Thanks, Max.
Adam. It's Adam. Adam. Sorry. That's kind of a relevant question. That's a machine that, you know, we've talked about Bamboo ad nauseum, but we've never, ever discussed the X1E. I don't even really know much about it. I guess I could have researched it before this episode started, but are you guys, either of you guys familiar with that?
Yeah, I've seen it. I went to Formnex, and it's a big convention, and they had some X1Es on display there. And basically, it's the, you know how there's this idea of the pink tax where, you know, girls, they want the pink version of something, so they have to pay twice as much for it, like razor blades or toothbrushes or whatever.
Yeah.
This is their version, that's Bamboo Lab's version of the corporate tax where... Like if a corporate customer wants to buy something, they pay twice as much for it, even though it's virtually the same thing as the X1. But yeah, I mean, the differences in the supply chain and the way that they support them, and it's got some slight improvements on there. But I wouldn't use any kind of cloud system with a corporate, like in a corporate environment, especially one where it's owned by a foreign entity. So I don't know. That's my thing with Bamboo Lab. It's not really fit for that kind of workplace, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, with an X1 Carbon or even my P1P, I can print LAN only mode on it. I don't have to go to the cloud with it.
Right. I mean, there's a whole discussion about privacy with any kind of cloud service. And just because a machine has a LAN only mode, like you don't know when it's going to upload things into the cloud. So it's like, you don't want to be risking it when you're dealing with kind of a corporate environment where you have IP that's valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had that discussion. Oh gosh. I don't know how many times. Well, I guess that what I'm saying is that I don't think that LAN only is the reason to charge $1,000 more for this. There's got to be something else they're doing with it. It's got to be like a support package or something else that's letting them charge $1,000 more for it. Cause I don't think the LAN only is a,
yeah. So I'm scrolling through their webpage right now, and they have a comparison with the X1C, and the X1E has air purification and an internal chamber heater and an Ethernet port.
That's it?
It seems like about it.
It seems like about it. Is there any difference? They talk about any difference in the support between the two?
They don't talk about support. Well, the tool head can get to 320 Celsius versus 300. So, I mean, that's another big one I missed it. I left out there. Sorry.
So Bamboo Lab doesn't sell those to you directly. You have to buy it through a third party. And that's like let's say a company has a reseller that they like to work with that they buy all their machines through. Mm-hmm. Then if they stock the Bamboo Lab X1E, then they can start, you know, buying that in. It's just like very minor differences. Another theory to explain the difference is in economics, they talk about this idea of, You ever wonder why you have so many options of the same thing at the grocery store? You go to get ketchup and there's like the $1 bottle of ketchup. There's the $2 bottle of ketchup. There's the $5. There's the $12.
The whole wall of ketchup.
I mean, that's just they sell it to you at different price points. And at the end of the day, the budget conscious consumer is always going to buy the best deal, which will be the least expensive ketchup. And even if someone only 10% of the time comes in and is like, you know what, I want to buy the $12 bottle of ketchup today, even if it's the exact same product, that extra profit from selling that $12 bottle of ketchup is going to pay for them to stock all those different options, even if they're the same thing. So, you know, there might be a little bit of that going on.
Yeah, that's true. But I will tell you, there's a big difference between ketchups. They all taste a little bit different.
Yeah.
You go from Hunt's to Heinz. Here in Indiana, we have Red Gold. So,
is that the best?
No, I don't like it. It's too sweet.
Yeah.
So, but anyways.
Oh, it's got extra corn syrup in it.
Yeah, it's really sweet. I don't like it. But yeah, like I said, I understand what you're saying that people have. I didn't know that this was only available through a third party.
Yeah. I didn't realize till right now, checking out their website. It's on their website. It's not a buy now button. It's a find a reseller button.
I didn't know that.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. But there are people that would just pay. All they know is they want a Bamboo and they tell their purchasing agent to do it. And the purchasing agent JJ says, just goes to who they usually buy equipment from and types in Bamboo. Yeah. Oh, here it is. Doesn't check.
And what Nathan was saying of
buys it from them.
Oh, do I buy a $2,000 printer or a $1,000 printer? Well, the $2,000 printer has to be twice as good. So
it's got to be better.
Oh, but I'll just click that one because I'm a billion-dollar company and I don't care.
Yeah. Right. It's cheaper than our last machine, so.
Yeah. For sure cheaper. And maybe those resellers have more support or other reasons that we don't understand, that we can't understand.
Right.
Yeah.
As, you know, this side of things.
They'll have someone come in and check the filament spool for you. For
yeah. They'll jiggle $100 the spool a week. For you a little bit.
I don't. I've never worked at a place where we've had a 3D printer or had a need for one.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I have a friend of the family who I think he's an engineer. Anyways, he said I gave him one of my printers, and he had been using the Prusas at work for a number of years. So I was surprised to hear that. Nathan, you said that's what you're using at your work too, correct?
Yeah. My last job, I just got the Prusas because it's like a known quantity. It's like, do you get the Prusa that's been out for basically 8 years, or do you get the hot new thing that just came out last week that all the YouTubers are talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you also mentioned the support is much better.
Yeah.
On the Prusa side. I've not experienced that, but I can see how that would make a huge difference. You know, especially the difference between a $300 printer and a, you know, an $800 printer in the case of the Prusa. The service, the extra service would be worth it to me.
Oh yeah.
As a business. You know, I can't imagine if we had a printer at work and I wasn't there and there was a problem with it. Yeah. That people would just walk away from it. And I don't know what to do.
And nothing gets done that day.
And nothing gets done that needed to get done.
Oh, we need things done today.
Yeah. Maybe those resellers would offer some kind of like basic training for how to use a 3D printer.
Yeah.
Because I could see that being valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. And that was a interesting conversation. And remember, we really do need questions and participation from you folks out there, the listeners. Make sure to go to perfectfirstlayer.com, go to the submit page and ask us. And Nathan, why don't you tell everyone where you can be found?
Just look up on YouTube, Nathan Builds Robots.
All right. JJ?
And I'm also on YouTube under JJ Shankles.
I can be found on YouTube at Guy Shop. And if somebody wants to email us a question directly, JJ, where do they send it?
Yeah, just send those emails over to perfectfirstlayer@gmail.com.
All right. Very good. And I guess we'll talk to you guys later.
Bye.
See you.